Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to welcome you to the Soleri Report. We're doing a special report with Dr. Joseph Farrell, and we're going to be talking about Goldman Sachs. We are now seeing a flood of Goldman Sachs alums and Goldman Sachs employees into the Trump administration. It's raising a lot of questions, and it brings up topics that Joseph and I have been discussing for years, including the rape of Russia, the hidden system of finance, the black budget, and the need to re-engineer federal government finances and how to do that when the covert operations are so very powerful and very important. So, Joseph, thank you for joining me on the Soleri Report and for doing this special.
Well, thanks for having me back. Yeah, we were talking about how necessary I think doing this little special report is, because I've been getting a lot of questions from my website members. I'm sure you've been getting them too. So we just kind of thought, well, let's do this and come up with our percentages of assessments of how optimistic or cautious we are.
Okay, well, there are several things I want to describe on background before we dive in and start with sort of discussing who is Goldman Sachs and why are they in the news. But the first is, just as a matter of disclosure, I worked at Goldman Sachs for the summer of 1977 and almost went to work there instead of going to Dillon Reed. So I have some history with Goldman Sachs. In fact, in 2008, you know, if you're an alum, you have online access to portions of their website and research reports and everything. I wrote them. I said, you guys are so corrupt, I don't even want to be on your alumni network. Please delete me. I've been giving them a hard time. You know, the big mystery during the financial crisis was who was going to be the number one user of our website that day. Was it going to be the New York Fed, Goldman Sachs, Fannie Mae, or the firm that was going down that, you know, during that three-week period? So, you know, when Bear Stearns went down, they're number one. But anyway, so there's an old history of me beating up on Goldman Sachs on the website. The other is we've seen an amazing sort of squabble come to boil coming into the inauguration of the new administration. And Chuck Schumer probably said it best the other day, last weekend, when he said, you know, you can't buck the intelligence agencies. They have six ways from Sunday to get you. And it's bringing up the old question, who's really in charge? Does the CIA work for the president, or does the president do what the CIA tells him to do? Mm. And Schumer was kind of a, you know, but this goes back to a long history that you and I have described in numerous speeches. And I wanted to just reference it. We're going to put a lot of links up with this when we post it for subscribers and your members. But I would strongly recommend, if you haven't seen Joseph and my presentation from the Secret Space Program 2014 to 2015, I think they're excellent backgrounds, because we get into the mechanics of how the hidden system of finance and the black budget work and interact. We discussed to a certain extent how it interacts with Wall Street, and I think that's very important background if you want to understand or get perspective on any of this. So I'll put up a lot of links. The other thing, Joseph, is you and I have been talking about this administrative transition in the U.S. government. We did one called the Trump Transition. We did one on the election. I did one with Rappaport and Making America Great Again. Again, I'll put all those links up, but I think we've covered some of this material already, and we're not going to repeat it. So that's great background as well.
I would add just one thing to the links. I would also mention that people might want to read my book, Covert Wars and Breakaway Civilizations, because that's the book that I attempt to outline as thoroughly as I can what I think some of the mechanisms of that hidden system of finance are.
Right. That's very good. Anyway, but I have a deep prejudice, and I just want to mention my conflict, because to remind people, I put it out on Twitter the other day, and that is, if you look at the CIA and the intelligence agencies, whether it's what has happened with my family or what happened with Hamilton Securities Group, you know, I basically consider them a criminal enterprise and have real reason to be fed up with them. So I'll just say it. I'm completely fed up with the arrogance of that system. So I have some pretty deep conflicts in the, in this conversation, and I just need to disclose them before we go on. So anything else in terms of references or conflicts you think we should bring up?
No, we can get into, I think, what we've discussed before later on about some internecine fighting within the intelligence community.
Right. Right. I would say there are 17 intelligence agencies in the United States and maybe 4 million factions therein.
Right, exactly.
It's what John Rappaport calls the fractured kingdom. Okay, so who is Goldman Sachs? Goldman Sachs is a global investment bank. They have about 35,000 employees. That compares to J.P. Morgan Chase, who's got about 232,000. So compare, you know, it's been an investment bank only serving institutions until very recently. Someone like J.P. Morgan does retail and has far more bureaucracy to do what they do. Goldman Sachs came up, it was started in the 1800s, and it really came up through the equity line. They became very well known for equity block trading. And then Robert Rubin was part of the department that really put them on the map in terms of equity arbitrage. So when the takeover battle started in the 70s and 80s, they were right in the thick of things. And they traditionally had a tremendous reputation for aggressive, but I would say ethical client service. And that line has, I would say the reputation has changed. They kept the aggression, but they haven't kept the reputation for ethics. Now, the reality is when you're an investment bank doing the different kinds of things they do, both trading and serving clients and managing money, by definition, you have different departments who take different positions. So it's possible to do a whole lot of things that don't look ethical. But really, if you look at Goldman's role, for example, in the engineering the strong dollar policy, the housing bubble, and all these different things, we've seen a lot of concrete evidence of highly questionable ethics and behavior. And I think it's why it makes people nervous when they trade in so many people in and out of government. I wanted to talk to help people understand the history of Goldman Sachs. I wanted to talk a little bit about the Exchange Stabilization Fund. I wanted to talk about Sullivan and Cromwell, and I wanted to talk about the role of the New York Fed. Because when you talk about Goldman Sachs, you literally have to talk about how the federal credit mechanism works. So if you look at the U.S. government, Joseph, the depository for the U.S. government, the government's bank account, is the New York Fed. And in fact, the New York Fed acts through its member banks. So the New York Fed is owned by its member banks, and it's acting as the depository for the U.S. government. So think of it this way. Treasury isn't run by Treasury. Treasury is run by the New York Fed.
Right.
I'm being a little bit facetious, but and one of the operations, so the New York Fed member banks basically control and implement the bank accounts for the U.S. government and a lot of the other servicing of financial liabilities and financial assets. So the U.S. government operationally and the Treasury operationally is deeply dependent on the New York Fed and the New York Fed member banks. That's why it's so hard to regulate them. It's like regulating your own bookkeeper. Do you know what I mean?
Right.
And one of the accounts that the New York Fed manages as agent for the Secretary of Treasury. Now, this is important to understand. The Exchange Stabilization Fund does not report up through the bureaucracy. It reports directly to the Secretary of the Treasury. There's no reporting line through the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy is entirely at the New York Fed, and it reports to the Secretary of Treasury directly. And the Exchange Stabilization Fund has broad authority to intervene in the markets. I call it the mother of all slush funds.
Yep.
There's a wonderful story I always use that was in Christopher Simpson's book Blowback that talks about the Dulles brothers sitting at Sullivan and Cromwell and using the Exchange Stabilization Fund to pull in all the monies that were seized from the Nazis.
Right.
And use it at the request of the Vatican to rig the Italian elections in 1948.
Right. It might be helpful for people to know also what the Exchange Stabilization Fund is supposed to do. What is it for?
Well, it's basically for stabilizing markets. I didn't bring with me the legal language of its purview, but what I believe it is it is used for broad intervention in markets and for all sorts of covert operations. I think it's at the very heart of managing the hidden system of finance, or the intersection between the black budget, the federal credit, and the hidden system of finance.
Those activities would include things, I'm sure, like manipulating the commodities markets, bullion markets, currency.
Absolutely.
Exchange rates. Right, right. It's very
right.
Important that people understand the details of what we're talking about.
Right, and the precious metal. I mean, the gold market is very much the purview of the Exchange Stabilization Fund.
Right.
Now, I have come to believe, looking back at the 90s, you had, during the Clinton administration, you had Bob Rubin first going in as National Economic Advisor and then becoming Secretary of the Treasury. And you had, back at Goldman Sachs, you had Lloyd Blankfein, who's now the chairman running the fixed income division, as his deputy is Gary Cohen, who is now the chief operating officer at Goldman Sachs, coming in as National Economic Advisor in the Trump administration. Blankfein came from J. Aron, who Goldman Sachs bought, a commodities firm. He came up through the gold desk. And in fact, Cohen likewise came up trading silver on the, he was a silver trader. And the two of them, both precious metals traders in essence, came up and ended up running the fixed income division at the very time when the strong dollar policy was engineered with sort of two key pillars. One was basically driving the value of the dollar up, and the other was driving the price of gold down, the suppression of the gold price. And if you look at Rubin at the White House and then at Treasury, and Blankfein and Cohen in the fixed income division, to this day, I believe that they were basically the nuts and bolts guys who helped Rubin engineer the strong dollar policy. At the same time that we were doing that, driving gold down and driving the dollar up, we were collapsing currencies around the world and running in and as we globalize, picking up things cheap. And one of my theories as to how that was done was they brought in tremendous amounts of money from Russia, the so-called rape of Russia. It's interesting, as Trump was running for president, we saw a former member of the intelligence agencies, had been at State Department, but I believe was really CIA, Steve Pachesnik, start giving interviews to Alex Jones and describing himself as somebody who was part of the Treasury covert operations that went in at the end of when the Soviet Union fell, and was part of basically privatizing the Russian economy. And one of their goals was to make sure that Western investment interests ended up controlling all the oil and gas.
Right.
But we know that in concert with the Russian mafia, a great deal of money was laundered in to the United States and into the Western world. And I've always believed Goldman Sachs was a major player in that operation. And so it's very interesting with Pachesnik saying that suddenly Goldman pops up to the extent that they now do in the Trump administration.
Right, exactly.
Let me say a few other things about Goldman Sachs, which I think are pertinent to our discussion. Their traditional general counsel, who was very, very intimately close when I worked at Goldman Sachs, you know, they as much were sitting all over the firm. It was a very integrated operation, and that's Sullivan and Cromwell. And as you know, Sulivan and Cromwell was the Dulles brothers' firm, and is, if any firm, legal firm, is associated with running the black budget and being deep into things like ESF operations, it's Sullivan and Cromwell.
And we need to add to the Dulles brothers, we need to remember that John J. McCloy was also a member of Sullivan and Cromwell, the former American High Commissioner for Germany after the war, and then a subsequent member of the Warren Commission with Alan Dulles. So we can get a measure of the power of that law firm and its connections with those three
right.
individuals.
Well, wasn't McCloy running the CIA when Kennedy was killed?
McCloy was, no, I think you're thinking of John McCone.
McCone.
Yeah.
Maybe McCloy was World Bank, I forget.
At that time, I think he did have a connection with the World Bank.
Yeah.
I don't recall exactly what it was, but I think you're correct there.
So, as part of the strong dollar policy, I give Goldman credit for really engineering, being the biggest brains in the engineering of the housing market, of the housing bubble. And if you remember, it was Goldman with the Big Short that brought it down starting in 2006. So they made money on the way up, and they made big, big money on the way down.
Right.
The reality, though, is the way down got out of hand. And when it did, we saw a bailout of AIG, and there's great deep questions about how much Goldman exploited the bailouts of AIG for their own benefit.
Right.
And they did it at a time when Hank Paulson, the Secretary of Treasury, was the former chairman of Goldman Sachs. And if you look at what Paulson proposed on the bailouts, there's no doubt that if we talk about the rape of Russia, Paulson and the bailouts in the United States was one of the many rapes of the United States. So in that sense, if you look at Goldman's role with AIG and Goldman's role with Paulson, it doesn't bode well for a heavy Goldman team. One of the things I want to mention is that one of the people who made a big investment at Goldman Sachs at the time is Warren Buffett. Now, he came in the form of preferred. If you look at Goldman's equity structure, it's the big index funds that own Goldman. But Buffett came in a preferred status, and I think he still has a reasonably large position. So when you talk about Goldman Sachs, you're also talking about Berkshire Hathaway and Buffett.
Right.
He's just got too much money up not to care. And, of course, if you're going to regather money into North America, Buffett's going to benefit enormously. He's benefited enormously already from the rise in the Trump rise of the equity market since Trump won.
Right.
So let me just look through a few other things on history before we go into the Trump administration. Goldman Sachs went public in 1999, so it's publicly traded, which means you can, whether at their website or the SEC, you can get a fair amount of information about them at the at their website or the SEC website. So they're required to file publicly proxies and annual reports, and there's an awful lot of information in it. Another thing I wanted to mention is, as Goldman Sachs traditionally was a major player in real estate, including New York real estate, they were the ones who helped the Rockefeller family recapitalize Rockefeller Center and sell it to the Japanese.
Right.
So, so you would expect, New York is very small, and the business and financial community is very small. So if you're Donald Trump and you live in that community, you're bound to know a huge amount of people who worked at Goldman Sachs or still work at Goldman Sachs, especially if you're in real estate. So they're going to be crossing, he's been crossing Goldman Sachs every day throughout his career. It's kind of like in Hickory Valley, there's no way you're not going to go to the Hickory Valley grocery store at some point. It's just too ubiquitous a player given the place.
Right.
And so it's important to understand that him having a lot of ties with Goldman Sachs doesn't in and of itself mean anything.
Right.
The other thing is, if you look out Wall Street, especially when I went there, you could kind of divide people up between players who represented the WASP, players who represented the Vatican, players that represented the Jews.
Right.
And those weren't clear-cut boundaries, particularly in real estate, because my bet is the Vatican has major, major positions in New York real estate, as does the Queen and a lot of other people.
Right.
But there's no doubt that Goldman came very much from the Jewish line. And their sort of breaking into the respectable underwriting business occurred with their first big corporate client, which was Sears. And another big one was Ford.
Right.
Their Chicago office was very important. Hank Paulson had come out of their Chicago office. And their Chicago office was very, very important to them. So Sears going down is really sort of the end of an era in terms of the wave that they rode of business, you know, what's good for General Motors being good for America. They really rode that wave. And they would be extremely sensitive to the fact that you know, as the middle class dies off, there's a huge world of corporations whose equity is dying with it.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, what's interesting is Goldman was always a very much institutional bank. And now what is happening is for the first time they've opened a retail division. They bought the GE Capital Bank. And with the bailouts, they started offering FDIC deposit insurance, and now they're offering, they've started an online lending arm, and that's been happening as they're running into more and more opposition globally. So as the world is getting a lot less friendly towards Americans, what we see with this retail arm, I think, is trying to figure out how they can make more money going deeper on North America.
Right, exactly.
And the markets, right. Another thing I wanted to mention about them is they were famous for investing a lot of money in philanthropy and doing it in a way that helped their fundamental underwriting business, and they were very aggressive at it. And there's some things in philanthropy when we get to the Trump administration that I want to talk about because I think they're relevant to what they're up to. Let me see if there's anything else. Okay, well, let's turn to the rape of Russia, because it's something that you and I have talked a lot about. I've had Ann Williamson on the Solari Report, and we've done a lot of discussion, you and I, and with Ann, on what happened. But why don't you just, can you give us an overview of what happened between the United States and Russia after the Soviet Union came down?
Well, basically, as far as I understand the story and have been able to follow it, when the Soviet Union collapsed, of course, you brought in Boris Yeltsin. And I have heard stories that when Gorbachev and Yeltsin were in this country, Yeltsin was off meeting with high financiers in this country. And, of course, once he becomes president of Russia, you had the rise of the oligarchs in Russia who were acting, insofar as we can tell, were acting in concert with American financial interests, buying up the properties of the old Soviet state for pennies on a dollar, which, of course, made, you know, concentrated the wealth of the old communist state in a very, very few hands, that in turn were taking that money and buying political influence and power within Russia and moving it toward a kind of Atlanticist political position. And in the interim, what we also saw happening in Russia at that time was the middle class basically collapsed. You had a severe power problem. You had some agricultural shortages that amplified. Pardon me. That amplified the problems in Russia. The other role, which you're more familiar with than I am, was the role of the Harvard Endowment in helping to buy up a lot of these properties. Now, what that did, and this is something I've told people about many, many times that American audiences don't get. But what that did was that it brought the Russian intelligence services, which were the KGB particularly, which was kind of a repository for Russian nationalism. We tend to think of it as an exclusively communist organization. But within Russian history, back in 1936, Stalin struck a deal with the then head of the Russian Orthodox Church, the locum tenens, which is kind of the metropolitan that handles things until a new patriarch is elected, kind of an equivalent position for people that are familiar with the Roman Catholic Church to the role that Cardinal Camerlengo, the Cardinal Chamberlain, plays in between elections when one pope has died and another one takes over. This is a similar position within the Russian Church. Stalin, in that deal, allowed the church to reopen a number of churches and to reopen some seminaries in return for an arrangement where the KGB, back then it was known as the NKVD, would recruit clergy into the intelligence organizations of Russia. Now, I've told people many times that view that as a compromise of the church by the intelligence agencies. Well, it's also working the other way around. It's also setting up a bureau within the Russian intelligence services that's basically being taken over by the church. So if you can imagine, and it's not hard to imagine because you can see this has happened to a certain extent in the American FBI, if you can imagine the FBI going to the Mormon church and saying, well, for you guys to continue to exist, we're going to have to recruit a lot of you into our organization. So what you pretty soon have is a bunch of Mormons in certain departments of the FBI. And this is what happens in Russia. So there's an element within the Russian National Security Service, the NKVD at the time, that becomes heavily suffused with people that have a kind of a dual allegiance, one to the communist state, but the other to the Russian Orthodox Church. So the intelligence services peculiarly become kind of a repository for a more traditional form of Russian nationalism. And it's very interesting. You know, I said this way back even when I was teaching Russian history in college. I pointed this out to my students. And it's interesting that in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, particularly with the advent of Mr. Putin onto the center stage in Russian politics, that you see a revival not only of the symbols of pre-communist Russia, in other words, symbols going back to the autocracy, with the double-headed eagle of the Romanovs prominently displayed on Russian flags in the Kremlin, statues to Russian saints, services inside the Kremlin after Putin took over of national repentance for the murder of the Tsar. You know, these little things don't make big news in the West, but in Russia they're highly significant. And in addition to this, now you see a group of advisors around Putin that come out of a school of philosophy within Russia called the Cosmists, many of whom were very deeply religious, and you see this school reemerging into Russian philosophical discussion of how to orient society. So in other words, when Putin comes in, you have him, of course, clamping down on the oligarchs, particularly those oligarchs with ties to the West that, you know, want to move Russia in a completely secular Western-style materialistic capitalist society, and Putin put a stop to that. So this is crucial for our understanding of what's going on in Russia and why he is viewed as such a threat to the West, because he put a stop to their financial plans for Russia. Basically, he put a stop to the rape of Russia.
Right, and I don't know how much money was laundered out of Russia during the 90s, but I know it was very significant. And one of the reasons I came to look at the amount of money that was coming out, and I should just back up, there's a wonderful book by a journalist who was killed right after he published it called Red Mafia, about the Russian Mafia. Right. Because clearly we teamed up with the Russian mafia, which was very much had a big toehold in New York and then got a big toehold in Israel because all those folks were eligible for Israeli passports, is what my understanding was. But we saw basically the Russian mafia, and my understanding from Red Mafia is the Russian mafia is 99% Jewish. And mm-hmm. we saw a lot of deep ties between the Jewish part of the New York financial community, the Russian mafia, and right. basically this covert operation of Treasury to pull all the money out.
Right.
And one of the reasons I ended up looking into it, because, you know, it's amazing, money, you know, it's like water. It just flows everywhere, and it makes for strange bedfellows. Mm-hmm. My company was hired to lead $12 billion of defaulted mortgage loan sales. And we did about $10 billion of auctions, and then the program was shut down. But one of the things we did was we hired AT&T Bell Laboratories to and use their optimization technology to auction the bids. And the reason that was so important, Joseph, was it allowed lots of different markets to bid. So rather than stratify the mortgages so that mortgage players had to bid or real estate players had to bid or securities players had to bid, we would let the bidder self-stratify, which meant you had all sorts of different markets coming in. And we made the disclosure packages very accessible. They were on Bloomberg, so you could be in Hong Kong and lob in a bid. And what happened was we had estimates of what we thought the bids would do. And Goldman Sachs consistently performed the best in terms of winning bids.
Right.
And, Joseph, they were bidding way over what I thought the market should be.
Oh, wow.
Way over. Wow. And I couldn't figure out, where are they getting all this money, and how can they afford to bid wildly over the market? And one of my theories came to be was that they were laundering the money in for Treasury. I absolutely believe that the Treasury or the intelligence agency, it could have been CIA, it could have been Department of Justice, were using Promise software to
right.
help them engineer the bids. So bidders would put bank deposit, you know, would wire in their deposit of 1% or 10%. And if you had Promise software, you could access the bank accounts and see how much people were wiring in, which right. meant you could get a bid, a beat on what they were bidding.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
I think what was happening was Goldman Sachs was not bidding as Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs was bidding on behalf of the Exchange Stabilization Fund. And one of the reasons Treasury wanted to win was they wanted to make sure they got all those files, because
right.
those files included tremendous amounts of financial fraud. You know, I've told you the story of how we were worried about what the fraud was going to be in the files when we went to get them in the Murrah building in Oklahoma City. And the bombing relieved us of having to get them. They just blew up the files. I should probably stop and give the audience a minute on Promise Software.
Yes.
Promise Software was developed by William Hamilton's company, Inslaw, and then basically stolen by the intelligence agencies.
Right.
Its initial power was the ability to access and conform disparate databases using, you know, that were using different software.
Right.
So it was an integrator, but it also ended up developing the capacity essentially to bust into bank accounts.
Right.
It was very much used by the U.S. intelligence agencies as a way of tracking money around the world. And at some point, the accusation was that it gave you not only the ability to view all the accounts, but also to transfer money in and out.
Right.
When I first called Bill Hamilton to talk to him, he said, "Have you read Black Money by Michael Thomas?" I said, "No." He said, "Read it and call me back." And I always tell people that when in connection with Promise, because it's kind of a quick beach reading way to understand the power of Promise software. And I think the creation of software tools that would compromise the financial system and their use by the intelligence agencies in part to manage the hidden system of finance is one of the things that got things going so crazy, in the 70s and 80s. And it was very funny because I had designed the loan sales to be able to beat a Manchurian candidate. I designed them so a Manchurian candidate could not compromise the sales, but I didn't know about Promise Software, and it never occurred to me that somebody would compromise by winning, bidding more.
Exactly.
I think that was one of the reasons we got hit. Treasury just got tired of paying a premium. So there I was representing the U.S. government. The U.S. government was compromising the loan sales, you know, and then trying to accuse me of doing what they were doing. So it was all very messy. But in the process, I had to deal with Goldman Sachs, or the people who worked for me had to deal with Goldman Sachs a lot. And I came to, I'll never forget a shouting match with one of my lead bankers who said something nice to about Goldman Sachs. And I turned to her and I said, "Goldman Sachs is not your friend." Well, because everything was about their winning,
right?
You know, and I don't mean that in a critical way. It was just, you know, they would have driven over their mother to, you know, to make another 10 cents, you know, if it was business. So they were extraordinarily aggressive, and you know, and the relationship banking by that point had gone out the door. And I think one of the reasons was just not the part was the change in globalization, but part was you had people rise to the top of the firm who were commodity traders and not, you know, from the banking side of the business. Cohen and Blackfein are definitely from the trading side. And, you know, that's one of the dangers. If they think short term and they think everything is a trade, then, you know, the United States is going to be traded. So let me just summarize what happened in Russia in the context of what I call the financial coup d'etat. If you look at every aspect of what I describe as $50 trillion stolen during the financial coup d'etat, so let's go back and look at it. Government securities fraud. Goldman Sachs is a primary dealer, one of the most, you know, powerful in that market. So they're in the thick of things. The pump and dump of the housing market, I think they were the brains. The suppression of the gold price, I think they were the brains. You know, the pump and dump of the equity markets, the internet stock bubble, they were right in the thick of things. The bailouts, they were right in the thick of things, and I think the AIG, big piece. One of the things we know is 9/11 involved all sorts of aspects with government securities fraud and gold.
Yes.
I believe AIG was managing the trading in the currency and bond markets on behalf of the Exchange Stabilization Fund. I think they made a fortune. But if AIG was in there doing that, it wouldn't surprise me if Goldman was there, but I have no proof of that.
Well, one thing we need to recall in this, as we're discussing 9/11 and the potential role of Goldman Sachs as kind of a front agent for the Exchange Stabilization Fund and a lot of these other activities. One thing we need to recall is that on 9/11, there were a number of financial investigations that were being conducted in conjunction with certain brokerage houses that were located in the World Trade Center. Some of these investigations were even being conducted out of the Pentagon by the Office of Naval Investigation.
Right.
I detailed that in my 9/11 book, and since we're talking, you know, putting all of this into the context of the incoming Trump administration, this would be or constitute a connection for him where he would be able to get intelligence about 9/11. I've always maintained that when he zinged Jeb Bush during the Republican primary with that statement about 9/11 truth, you know, being an inside job and all of that, and that his family was involved, you know, and then days later Jeb Bush drops out of the race, this would be a potential source of that information. So again, you know, my take on that comment that he made during the primary campaign was always that this was not just simply Trump being Trump and shooting from the hip. This was a carefully timed release of information and a carefully timed message. So that's something to bear in mind as we proceed.
Right. So whether we're talking about the financial coup d'etat or we're talking about the CIA's management of the hidden system of finance, you know, what you're talking about is you're talking about the nuts and bolts implementers for a lot of it. So if you said to me, who was the brains that engineered the financial coup? Just, you know, and it's going to be more than one person and more than one firm, but pick you think the biggest part of the brain. I would say Goldman Sachs and Sullivan and Cromwell. Right. Then you would say who at Goldman Sachs? I'd say Blank, Fine, and Cohen. That's how traders get to run a firm. Right. You know, because that was a fantastic, in terms of sort of building up Goldman Sachs's financial power and muscle, you know, being a winner at engineering that was the way you got to the top. So whether you like the financial coup or not, these are the guys who did it.
Right.
Now, it brings us back to our age-old question, why? But these are the guys who did it, and these are guys who globalized all the money. And now, if you're going to reshore it all back to North America, you know, it's logical if you're going to, you know, if these are the guys in the engineer pulling all the money out and taking it around the world, if you were going to bring some back, it'd be logical you'd use the same guys to bring it back.
Yeah, and this raises, if I can interject, this raises a number of important points. The first concerns what I've been calling the hidden system of finance, and the second raises the reshoring itself and why it's a geopolitical necessity for them to do this. And, you know, I said this years and years ago that, you know, in my conversations with the late George Ann Hughes on her radio show, that it looked to me like what we were seeing were the very beginnings of a move to massively beef up their power base in North America and essentially reshore things. But the hidden system of finance, just to round it out or remind people of what I've been saying about it, this is not the black budget. This is a completely off-the-books system of finance that has been used both as a political slush fund for covert operations, for economic warfare, and for ultimately, I think, for given the massive amounts of money involved in it, for the covert funding of black research projects, you know, exotic science, essentially.
Right.
Historically, this system was set up by President Truman in a decision that he took in 1947 after he had signed the National Security Act into law that basically placed the operational management of that system into the hands of the National Security Council, which means, effectively, that what he did was he put the American intelligence community directly into the banking business. And as I think it was at that first conference that you mentioned in your references, where I mentioned the fact to people that if you're going to set up a system like this, you have to have the participation at some level in that system of the major prime banks and investment houses of the West. So certainly you'd be looking at a firm like Sullivan and Cromwell on Wall Street. You'd be looking at a Goldman Sachs. You'd be looking at a J.P. Morgan Chase, Hong Kong, Shanghai Bank. You know, all the big international banking players would be a part of this operation. I think Deutsche Bank. You know, the big
banks clearly
as well. Yeah,
right.
So that's the other thing people need to bear in mind here.
One of the things I believe is if you look at the Exchange Stabilization Fund, you're talking about an entity that aligns the black budget with the hidden system of finance, because the two end up sort of ping-ponging back and forth. They're separate, but they're aligned and they ping-pong, if you will. And what you have is you have within the U.S. government, you have a shadow government, which is in every agency and in many different parts of the agency, you have attorneys who interact with their private counterparts behind attorney-client privilege. So if you ever study how the U.S. government runs narcotics trafficking in communities, attorney-client privilege is a critical part of doing that.
Right.
And and setting things up so it's under the guise of national security law, and the lawyers are operating behind attorney-client privilege is right. is critical to that ping-ponging back and forth between the two. Because the question is, how do you share the information about the hidden system of finance in a way that can coordinate with the black budget? And the reality is, you know, you share it behind national security law and you share it behind
right.
attorney-client privilege.
Right.
Two other players I wanted to mention. If you look at Goldman Sachs' board, still on their board of directors is Jim Johnson, who was head of Fannie Mae during the engineering of the housing bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And so very important player in that role. But another interesting one, if you look at the pump and dump of the housing market, New York was very, and the New York real estate players were very important to that whole effort. I suspect a lot of the money coming in on Russia got reinvested in real estate.
Yep.
But one of the players you saw who played a big part in that role was Jamie Gorelick, who at the time was was the number two at Department of Justice. And what would happen is, I know in our lawsuit, when we were targeted, the various parties, including the Department of Justice, kept falsifying evidence against us, and then we'd catch them. And part of our challenge was there were two lawsuits involving the loan sales, two primary ones. One was in a secret court, which wasn't public, and one was in a public court. And the Department of Justice was taking opposite positions in the two courts. So in the secret court, they're saying the sky is green, and in the public court, they're saying the sky is blue.
Right.
And they went to great lengths to keep them under different judges and to keep them separate. And because they had so much trouble coordinating taking opposite positions in opposite courts, they had Jamie Gorelick as the overall person overseeing all of this.
Right. Yep.
Okay. Which was, and you know, this was one of several, I'm sure, things she was doing to make sure that the housing bubble could really go. And so what you're watching is you're watching government engineer financial fraud in violation of the financial laws in a very significant way. And she was rewarded by then becoming vice chairman of Fannie Mae, despite the fact that she's a lawyer, has absolutely no experience in housing other than destroying housing programs and engineering financial fraud for, you know, the intelligence agencies. So where does she pop up? She's the attorney representing Jared Kushner in the sort of review of how he can take care of his conflicts of interest and go work for Trump.
Right.
So we have Jamie Gorelick in there, and you almost wonder, well, what did she do for the New York real estate guys while she was pumping and dumping the housing market? She was also critical into building the private prisons.
Yep.
And there were many people who thought that if Clinton won, that Jamie Gorelick had a shot at being attorney general.
Right.
Right. So, you know, it's another reminder that you're watching the same cast of characters.
Yep.
You know, as did all the shenanigans in the 90s. Okay, so let's talk about who's who in the Trump administration. The Goldman Sachs beat started off when Steve Bannon was appointed White House advisor. Bannon's been gone from Goldman Sachs many years, and I think it's very important when you look at this question. A lot of people have cycled through Goldman Sachs over the years. So I worked at Goldman Sachs. Lots of people have worked at Goldman Sachs.
Sure.
The fact that Steve Bannon worked there long ago doesn't really, I don't think, means that much. Whereas Gary Cohen, who's the chief operating officer, clearly was right in the thick of engineering many different aspects of the financial coup d'etat, is
right.
going in straight from Goldman as national economic advisor. And frankly, my guess is, Joseph, that wasn't his idea. Somebody said, okay, Gary, we need you to go in here and
right.
make sure that when they re-engineer everything, they don't mess up the derivatives and finance, you know, the bond picture. So we need a nuts and bolts guy in there
yep.
making sure all
yep.
this works for us. So when you turn the federal budget, you know, you turn all the financial markets and you need somebody who everybody trusts as a nuts and bolts guy in the middle of it to make sure it all works.
Right.
Okay. Right. And it turns out if Gary Cohen had it in his heart to be a Titanic turner, that's not a bad idea.
Right.
If he has it in his heart to be a pig, we got a big, big problem.
Well, this is, you know, this is why I think the geopolitics here is so very crucial, because the Bush and Obama administrations have managed in 16 short years of disastrous foreign policy to turn a great deal of the world against us. And the bottom line is, and this has always been my take on it, the bottom line is you can't run an empire without a military that can sustain it. And you can't run a military
right.
to sustain an empire if parts of your major weapon systems are being built here and there and under license to this foreign company and that foreign company, where there is no manufacturing base in the country. So that's problem
right.
number one. I think that, you know, the 3D printing, and I've said this for years, that this is something that's factoring into their consideration, that they don't need the big industrial plants to build things for them anymore. They can farm it out and disperse it and disperse the targets, quite literally, is what I'm talking about.
Right.
But they do have to reshore. That's the problem. They do have to reshore because they've now got virtually the whole world mad at them for American intervention, American military projects, the disastrous Arab Spring. It's been largely America that's been behind the refugee crisis in Europe, you know, with Merkel acting as their puppet in this respect. So there's a lot of ill will, and for the oligarchy, it's necessary for them to shore up the base of their power, which is still North America. So this is the geopolitical reasoning here that I lean on the optimism side, that, you know, this is not just talk. They're very serious about doing this because they have to.
Well, I agree with you, and I think it's twofold. One is they're afraid if there is a war, they're going to lose.
Exactly, right.
That's number one. But number two, if you're Goldman Sachs and you're basically getting kicked out of China,
right.
Or, you know, I just think that part of this was the greed on the digital and Silicon Valley side.
Right.
Once
yep.
you discovered that everybody's systems have zero integrity,
yep.
then you just want them out. There's no point. I mean, I think that we basically said to the world, we're scorpions, and there's no point in doing business with us because we'll always screw you no matter what.
Right. Right. Exactly. And people are waking up to this. You know, I'm with you. I've been looking at some of the moves that have been made very quietly against Germany. I do think there's a covert economic war going on against Germany. I think the refugee crisis is a part of it, one part of it. But we see, you know, the fines against Volkswagen. And I suspect that we're going to see some shenanigans being played out with Deutsche Bank. But yeah, they've got to reshore, not out of any altruistic motivation, I don't think, to help, you know, the American middle class, other than they need that middle class to continue buying their products. And under the system that's obtained in the last 30 years, that's crumbling. Obamacare didn't help. And they've also got to maintain the empire. So you can't run a prosperous empire and have a strong military if you've outsourced all the manufacturing, number one.
Right.
And you can't have a strong empire if you've outsourced and basically strip-mined middle-class wealth and left them with no discretionary income. So it's necessary, I think, for them, trying to read the tea leaves here.
Well, let me keep going because so the first person was Steve Bannon, who I don't really consider very much Goldman Sachs. The second was Steve Mnuchin, who had left Goldman Sachs, been gone for quite a while, but was deemed to be sort of more Goldman Sachs because his dad, Bob Mnuchin, was a very famous Goldman partner, had come out of the equity side when Gus Levy was running it. In fact, I met him when I worked at Goldman Sachs. And so the Mnuchins were really Goldman Sachs royalty, if you will. And Mnuchin went to Yale and was tagged for Skull and Bones. So you've got a Skull and Bones guy who's sort of Goldman Sachs royalty. And he was in the fixed income division with Gary Cohen and Blankfein as part of the engineering of the, you know, the strong dollar policy in that whole period. And it's right. Really funny. You almost feel like Yeltsin is going to show up for some kind of honorary position here.
So. Well, you know, he's dead, but he's still suffering a hangover with a half-life of 50 years, so you never know.
You never know. Okay, so there was Mnuchin, and that, because that's the Secretary of Treasury position. And then we had Gary Cohen come in to be National Economic Advisor, and that's a much more direct post.
Yep.
Because Cohen is really at the heart. You name it, if it's got somebody, you know, you name every vampire squid allegation in the world, and Cohen is right at the heart of it.
Right. Yep. Yep.
Anyway, so, but again, the National Economic Advisor is not a position approved by the Senate the way the Secretary of the Treasury is. Well, then here's what's interesting, because, so then we have a Sullivan and Cromwell partner, Jay Clayton, announced as the head of the SEC. Now, yep. if you're going to engineer a turn and a reshoring and particularly take advantage of the place-based opportunity, then having Cohen as National Economic Advisor and an SEC, and a Sullivan and Cromwell partner at SEC starts to get very interesting, because one of the things we know is that Wall Street is looking for regulatory relief. In fact, all of America is looking for regulatory relief.
Right.
But Goldman Sachs, now, since last summer, when Trump started to come up in the polls, how much do you think Goldman Sachs' stock is up by?
Oh, I would imagine a great deal.
72%.
Oh, my word. Well, I would never have guessed that.
Here's what's interesting. Well, they've gotten pretty beaten down. If you look at the trading in the U.S. equity markets, NYPD gets a hold of Anthony Weiner's laptop. The judge gives the FBI authority to access it. And literally the next day, the market starts to trade Trump's victory.
Yep.
And that's 8 days before the election. But from the month, from that day and for a month after the election, 50% of the rise in the Dow came from three stocks, the number one being Goldman Sachs.
I can believe that. I can believe that, definitely.
So Booz Allen Hamilton, who's been briefing the president-elect instead of the CIA, started trading up within 24 hours, and then Goldman Sachs 48 hours.
Right.
And their stock's been rising ever since. So whatever that deal was between Trump, NYPD, you know, Goldman Sachs was in the thick of that.
Yep.
And so you wonder. Yeah, I'd love to know who was in the room for that negotiation and deal, because that's when the Clinton people stood down, whether Clinton knew it or not.
It's not only that, but it's peculiar to me now that Hillary has apparently made noises that she wants to run for mayor of New York. And if that is the case, my suspicion is strongly that she wants to get in there, get her hands on whatever files they have, and run the shredder over time. So, yeah, this is still an ongoing contest. But there's something else I think we need to mention with respect to Goldman Sachs and Booz Allen Hamilton and Dr. Pechenik. And that is, I've said all along, and I think what we have to bear in mind is that we're looking at the real public face of some real factional infighting between the neocon, neoliberal crowd within the intelligence community. It's looking to me, Catherine, like what is happening here is that they want to wrest, and you've said this already, they want to wrest the intelligence agency control of this hidden system of finance and privatize it.
Right.
Roll it out of the government. And what's very interesting to me is if you look at Trump's other appointments, the military and so on, what you see is I think, a new alignment taking place within the military intelligence complex, basically walling off the CIA,
right,
excluding them.
So I think this is a very important insight, and I just want to spend a little bit of time on it, because if you look at the central banking warfare model, you have the military, and then you have the central bank, the money. So you have money and you have force. And what's very interesting is there's a world of people over on the military side who do real things. You know, they build boats, they sail the boats around, they police the sea lanes, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have people on the money side, and they do the servicing and, you know, balance the books and all that kind of stuff. And what I think you're seeing is the people who do essential things on both sides are getting fed up with the fluff.
Yep.
And what they're saying is, we don't need 1,000 people to do these functions, and we don't have time to placate these 800. We can do this with 200 people, and it's almost as though you have a revolution of the people who are responsible for operations on both sides saying, let's make a deal and cut out all this waste.
Right.
Because we don't have time for them. The other thing is, you've had three presidents in a row who basically are, you know, you had a series of you had two lawyers. So Bill Clinton was a lawyer. And then, you know, George Bush was just a silver spoon in the mouth. And then Obama's a lawyer, but there's nobody who understands money, deals, and can count.
Right.
And the thing is financially has gone not only, you know, it's just financially out of control. And so I think you're seeing a productivity backlash on the covert side of life. Both the military and the finance side. And the brains of the operations on both sides are saying, you know, too many people, too much fluff, we can't afford it.
We're
in danger of losing. We got too much overhead.
Right.
Right.
We've got too much fluff, and what it's done is it's driven up the cost of weapons systems that don't work. I just read a story about the Navy dropping their $800,000 per round. Stop and imagine that. Basically an artillery projectile that costs almost $1 million, you know, that they've dropped this. So, and then you had Trump sending a little message about Air Force One, you know, that we're not paying that much money for this plane. And that's a bottom line there. That's sending messages. So I think your reading here is exactly correct, that you've got people that are just tired of the fluff and all the overhead and cost and non-productivity that it creates in the system. Absolutely.
Right. So, so here's the interesting thing. If you look at so let me keep going on the people coming in from Goldman.
Sure.
So we have a guy who left Goldman, who runs Skybridge Capital, coming in as senior White House advisor. His name is Scaramucci, Anthony Scaramucci. And he is bringing with him someone who is at Goldman Sachs, and this gets very interesting. You know, Goldman Sachs has had all sorts of forays into social, what I would call socially responsible investment. During the bailouts, they would constantly run pictures of very large black women and talk about their 10,000 small business initiative and social impact and their foundation doing all these great things. So you have a machinery that's destroying small business on one side, you know, and using government to do it in a way that's uneconomic, and then taking a tiny portion of their profits and doing good works.
Right.
So, you know, it's just deeply as offensive as you and I can imagine. But anyway, so it's you have a Dina Habib Powell. She's Egyptian, and but went to, I think she went to University of Texas. She worked in the Bush administration. She had been hired after the Bush administration to run their impact investing, which oversees, they say, $4 billion in housing and community development, and then leads the corporate foundation. So if you're going to take advantage, so remember, we've got Warren Buffett and everything that Goldman Sachs is trying to do in place space. Now, remember, Goldman Sachs is a major player in the municipal bond market.
Yep.
So Goldman Sachs is as knowledgeable as there is on Wall Street about place-based financing.
Right.
So with the arrival of Dina Powell, and, you know, between Cohen on the derivatives and fixed income and sort of the covert hard stuff, and Powell on the, you know, on the social responsibility and goody-two-shoes stuff, you know, whether it's overt, covert, you really look like a team that's getting set. And then you add Warren Buffett in the picture, who's clearly set his equity to take advantage of this.
Yes, absolutely.
So, right. So I think these guys are absolutely, in terms of nuts and bolts engineers, looking at how you reoptimize the economy here in North America, how you set it up so you can bring in a lot of capital, and how you set it up so you can make money on that capital.
Right.
And it brings me back to the question you've been, I've been talking about, you know, for years now, which is, we have a lot of the economy run through the federal budget and federal credit. That's not good. If anything, we need to decentralize.
Yep.
But the question about that money is it going to be operated at a negative return on investment as it is now? Or is it going to move to a positive? Now, it can get more negative. If they do a rape of Russia too, it's going to get much more negative. You're going to wipe out the middle class.
Yeah.
And they're going to all feast at the trough. So so that's the question. Can they turn it positive? Can they turn it negative? And the interesting thing is, if you look at the team they're bringing in from Goldman Sachs, these are people who could turn it positive if they wanted to.
Yep.
They have the skills to do it.
This brings us to the heart of the issue, so I'm going to ask.
So before we dive in there, can I just step back up to the squabble that's going on in Washington right now?
Sure.
Because you have the Trump team and the nominees coming in, and basically they're very clear their goal is make America great again. So rebuild the North America economy, and that is goal number 1, 2, 3. And so, this is a group of people who are definitely recommitted or committed to reshoring, and they're running into tremendous opposition. And the question is that opposition people hopeful? I mean, I don't see any hope to turn this back into the unipolar empire.
No, I don't either. I don't either. For several reasons.
So the question is, what are they playing for? The team that's resisting, what are they trying to accomplish?
Well, I think the key here is several factors, but one of them is this hidden system of finance and who's going to control it, because there's so much money sloshing around in it,
right,
that it enables, you know, just through sheer fraud, it enables people to line their pockets and continue to harvest wealth at the cost of everybody else. So I think part of this problem is that we're looking at just sheer greed. The other part of the problem, as you've pointed out many times, Catherine, is you've got control files on a lot of these people. So the people wanting to retain that power and keep things going on the finance capital model of things, just think of George Soros in this respect. You know, this is a man that makes his money not by producing anything, but simply by, you know, trades, securities or whatever. currency, whatever it is, but he's not based in equity capital, and people like Buffett and so on are. And you're seeing, I think, a bit of backlash and a bit of a struggle between those two ideologies, financial ideologies, if you will. But part of the resistance, I think, is just coming from the fact that the control files on a lot of these people that are leading the opposition are pretty deep, and those who want to continue their operation of that system with all the fraud sloshing around in it are using those control files, and so you better fight tooth and nail every step of the way. I don't think it's going to work because I think the intelligence community is badly divided between the military and the producing people and that group of people. So that's one factor. The other factor I think that we have to figure in here is a lot of that opposition, particularly in Hillary Clinton's, the Bush-Clinton network, let's just put it that way, because I really think the Bushes are the ones behind the Clintons. If you look at that network, there are a lot of foreign influences in it, Saudi money and so on and so forth. Heavy donations from the Saudis to Hillary Clinton, even donations from Angela Merkel to Hillary Clinton. So they're heavily invested in that whole international unipolar empire enterprise, part of which is, of course, the heavy reliance of that enterprise on finance rather than equity capital. So I think you're looking at that factor. And the final factor I really genuinely think that's operative here is that group has basically been in charge of this country for so long, again, going back to the fact that this hidden system was established by Truman in 1947.
Right.
It basically occupies the country. It stages a coup d'etat with the assassination of President Kennedy. So we're looking at a long-term phenomenon. And they've lived in that bubble for so long, they can't conceive of any other way of doing things or acting or behaving other than what they have been doing all along. And, you know, it's a species of unreality. It's a species of insanity in a certain sense that we're also dealing with.
Well, it's interesting. What we're watching is, if you look at the Trump appointees, you know, as far as I know, the only lawyer is White House counsel and the head of the SEC, where you really have to have a lawyer.
Sure.
I mean, obviously, in DOJ Sessions is an attorney, but he's not. You know, the Clintons and Obama were lawyer, 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 and everything. And, you know, now you're talking instead about people who understand price. So we've been trying to build a society based on rules instead of a society based on price. And the price guys are leading a revolution and coming back in and talking price.
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
Right.
It's a real ideological struggle that we're looking at. And I've said all along, Catherine, this election wasn't an election, it was a referendum on several things. And whether Trump had been in there, it would have been somebody else if it wasn't Trump. And if he's not successful, you're not going to see this phenomenon go away. It will reemerge. And it will reemerge, I think, if he is unsuccessful. If we are, in other words, if we're looking at a rape of Russia scenario here, then you're going to see the same coalition that backed him this time reemerge and back somebody else.
Right.
The real question is, what are we looking at? Are we looking at positive return on investment? Is that the scenario we're looking at? Or are we looking at rape of Russia 2 on steroids?
One thing I don't understand, and I want to come back to it again, is the attitude towards Russia. Because, you know, in the last 2 weeks, it has been... you know, sort of the dialogue about Russia and Washington has been, if you're an American, humiliating, because you're watching people behave, you know, it's like watching kindergarten. And, you know, so there are people who are violently, you know, they're sort of Russia rabid mad, let's kill Russia rabid mad dogs. And you can't, when they talk the way they talk, you can't get a logical reason from them on why we should, you know, go blow up Russia.
My intuition, Catherine, is, and this is going to sound crazy, but during the summer there were a couple of articles that appeared on the internet. I think it was the Swedish interior minister that came out and said something to the effect that the enemy to the New World Order is Russian Orthodoxy. And then somebody else, I forget who it was, also came out and said pretty much the same thing. This is a long-term Western visceral kind of innate subconscious reaction to Russia because, number one, Western Christians don't understand Orthodoxy. They just don't. And I tell people if you want to understand Orthodoxy, you have to unlearn everything that you think you know about Christianity. Because it's a totally different way of thinking about the fundamental doctrines of the religion. But the other thing is, we need to remember that Russia, as a nation, was midwifed into existence by Orthodoxy. So it is so deeply suffused in Russian culture. And if you're looking at something that you don't understand, that is vaguely familiar to you, on the one hand, and yet at the same time foreign, you have a visceral reaction against it. I think this is a large part of the anti-Russian hysteria. People just don't understand what they're dealing with, and therefore, you know, the easiest way to understand something that you don't want to understand is to vilify it, demonize it, and attempt to destroy it so that you don't have to think about it anymore.
Well, but I think, in a practical sense, that there are four things going on, and I just want to throw them out to you. One is we are watching a war on cash globally coming out of Davos in the United States, which is, I would say, reflects a level of desperation that is concerning.
Yep.
And Russia clearly stands in the way,
yep,
of a global cash control, global digital payment system.
Right.
And they are the number one stinker. That's number one. Number two, if we're going to control from space, they're a threat.
Yep, exactly.
Because they have the, you know, the capabilities of playing in space and with weapon technology in a very major way.
Yep.
The third thing is they have played the soft revolution card brilliantly. And we have failed completely.
Yes.
It was very interesting. Mattis, in his testimony for as his nominee hearing, mm-hmm, for Secretary of Defense, said, you know, to project power, we need military power, and he didn't use the word soft revolution, but soft revolution power, and he said on soft revolution, you need inspiration, and we are way too dependent on force, and we're short inspiration.
Well, let me address that one point, because President Putin gave a Christmas message that I wish people would go watch.
I put it up on my website.
Ah, good, because what he did in that message was he addressed certain cultural trends in the West, particularly during the Obama years. You know, the whole transgender bathroom thing and everything else. And he directly addressed the immigration crisis in Russian terms by saying, you know, we need, of course, to continue to protect the rights of minorities in Russia. And at the same time, the next sentence out of his mouth was, but we will never allow the culture of the majority to become hijacked by minorities. And what he was doing, Catherine, was he was addressing directly, not just people inside of Russia, he was addressing the West and to people in the West that have watched this multicultural agenda erode the institutions and landmarks and monuments of their civilization. That's what he was addressing. So in other words, he was saying, if you feel disenfranchised in the West, we here in Russia understand your plight. We understand what you're fighting for.
Right. The thing he brought up, and I thought it was very powerful, is the way he described the debasement of the culture in the West,
right,
and why it was destroying the West. The West,
right,
was being destroyed, and right. it was being destroyed through the debasement of culture. But the other thing he brought up is he brought up pedophilia as the ultimate example
yep.
that documents their debasement.
Right.
And he used the word pedophilia twice,
yep.
If I recall. And I think that goes right at the heart of the Anthony Weiner laptop.
Oh, yes.
And
yeah, he was
it's
clearly
one of the reasons.
Messages.
Right. I think if you look at Rubio, if you look at Graham, if you look at McCain, they are behaving exactly the way I saw the Secretary of HUD behave when, when I was at HUD and he was being blackmailed, or it was alleged that he was being blackmailed over pedophilia.
Right.
You know, people under threat of blackmail for pedophilia do not act rationally. And,
no, they don't.
Right.
And the thing that this whole question raises, and again, I think this goes to directly to why you had those statements appearing in the summer from European ministers that, you know, the whole problem with the New World Order is orthodoxy. In other words, it's Russia. Is precisely that you know, we're not the only ones that would have control files on these people.
Right.
I suspect the Russians know a great deal about all of these people. And the threat is that they could release it. So, as you say, you've got Russia poses a threat in space. It is not going to move to a cashless system. As a matter of fact, we've talked about this a couple of years ago with the Russians instituting their own internal financial clearing systems independently of any
right.
American or Western corporation. And then they turned around. And this is something we need to bear in mind, too, as we're looking at positive return on investment or rape of Russia, too. The Russians 2 years ago, if I recall the time correctly, made an agreement with Japan that gave Russia access to the Japanese credit, I forget what it's called, the Japanese credit banking system or something. In other words, the major financial clearing in the Pacific is run by a Japanese company. You know, this is all over the Pacific, and the Russians got access to this. And that was kind of to my way of thinking, looking back in retrospect, that was something that prepared for the agreements that they reached after the Onsen summit last month in December of 2016. So the cashless, the Davos thing, I think you're exactly correct. This is a desperation move. And the only thing it's going to produce, again, we've talked about this, the only thing it's going to produce is it's going to produce the rise of local and regional currencies. People just cannot survive on digital clearing systems alone that are not secure. This is the whole problem,
right.
As you've said over and over and over again. The real question is are they going to try and do something like that here in the midst of all of this return on investment? Is it going to be positive, or are we going to have a rape of Russia too? Well, I would suggest that one powerful message that we might be looking at a rape of Russia scenario is if indeed they try and pull some similar stunt here as they've pulled in India. So, you know, that's one thing that we need to watch for.
Right. Well, they've been steadily, you know, the constraints on cash have been happening quietly, steadily all along. But Well, here's why I ask it. So here's Goldman Sachs intimately involved with the Treasury and the rape of Russia, and yet they are now aligned with a president making pro-Russian
right.
or certainly making sense on Russia as opposed to the sort of the Russian hawks.
Right.
And it's an interesting realignment that doesn't, you know, you kind of look at it and shake your head. You would think that having helped steal all that money out of Russia, they might be a Russian hawk themselves. But now Goldman Sachs is always, you know, ready to switch and play ball today. They're an investment bank, and it's, you know, everything's about what makes money today.
Well, so, let me offer a speculation here on what might be going on here with that very thing, this changing of attitude by aligning with Trump, who clearly has made it, I think, pardon me, very clear that he wants to have a very different relationship with Russia. We've seen several hints that this is in the making over the past few years. We saw Kissinger break with Brzezinski in several articles that he wrote. He made several trips privately to see President Putin and then wrote these articles that the United States needs to quit demonizing Russia and rethink its whole policy. And now we see Trump voicing the same thing, incoming president-elect, and we see Goldman Sachs change sides, so to speak, on this whole thing. I think what you're looking at is a real attempt to get as close to Russia as possible, both in terms not only of perhaps an eventual lifting of the sanctions regime, but on security matters dealing with Islamic terrorism and so on. But also we need to remember that Russia has been trying desperately to develop the infrastructure in Siberia, to develop the tremendous resources that it has available in Siberia. And they have turned to China in the past few years to get the capital to do this, and now we see them opening up to Japan to get Japanese money to do this. And I think the whole reason that Russia did this is to offset any potential Chinese influence in Siberia. They're playing a very careful balance of power political game vis-a-vis Siberia. And with that realignment taking place, I think If you're a geopolitical financier in an investment bank like Goldman Sachs, you're seeing this is the perfect opportunity to get some capital in there, into Russia, and make it work in a productive fashion that everybody benefits. And you create a geopolitical realignment in the process that is going to further isolate China. So I think that's my speculation on why Goldman Sachs appears to be aligning with Russia, or pardon me, with Trump after it, you know, was involved in the rape of Russia previously. And I can bet my bottom dollar that this is probably the way the analysts in Moscow are looking at things too. I think this is what you're seeing.
Right, and it's one of the reasons for Tillerson as Secretary of State, because
bingo, exactly.
He's basically the guy to negotiate what we do with Russia in the Arctic Circle.
Exactly.
And if you want to get back in the lead on the Arctic Circle and make sure it's not the Chinese, then
yep.
You know, I keep coming back to what Jack Ma said, which is when trade stops, war starts.
War start, right. Exactly.
So to a certain extent, what you're looking at with Tillerson and Trump and the Goldman Sachs guys is the let's make a deal party.
Yep.
These are deal people, right?
I think so.
And they're price people. They don't care about lawyers and rules. They care about price.
Right.
So if it's not economic, it's, you know, they're going to throw it out, good or bad.
Well, it's also a realization that the Rape of Russia plan didn't work.
Right.
You know, they realize now that the Russians simply are not going to allow that sort of thing to happen, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're not open to making a deal. That's a
right.
very different matter. So, you know, getting back to, are we looking at positive return on investment scenario, or are we looking at Rape of Russia 2? That at least is a factor on the side of positive return of investment scenario. Because the other problem here is the empire, so to speak, is faced with a real security problem now that it helped
right.
create with the refugee crisis and so on, the mess that Hillary and Obama made in Syria and elsewhere in the Middle East. This is something that they've got to address, and they've got to address quickly. We're looking at Turkey, you know, a very significant NATO member that looks like it's breaking away to a certain extent from being basically a sock puppet for Washington's policies in the region. So there's a lot going on here, but that's one factor that I think puts it in the positive return on investment column rather than the Rape of Russia column.
Well, here, you know, if you brought in a team that didn't know anything about the kinds of things we're talking about, let's say they had no understanding of the covert side.
Right.
You couldn't you couldn't flip it to positive, because the number one obstacle to flipping the negative return on investment to positive is figuring out how you're going to handle the covert piece.
Right.
And if you don't know the covert piece, you're just going to, you know, have happened to you what happened to me in the 90s, which I figured it wasn't my problem. It was the covert guys who'd figure that piece out. And, of course, we were out of alignment, and I didn't know it. So, I mean, it's interesting because I think of the CIA networks as the one that drug, more than anyone, run the drugs into the U.S. neighborhoods. And it's going to be very interesting because if military intelligence is going to team up with the finance side and re-engineer this, it's going to, you know, you could really see those CIA networks get squeezed out. You know, they squeezed out organized crime, and now the organized crime guys have come in on the overt side and are squeezing them out.
And squeezing back. And we need to remember historically, you know, since you mentioned the covert side and CIA and drug running operations, this is not something that is made up. You know, you had the work of Gary Webb, but you also had all of those allegations going back to the Clintons, MENA, Arkansas, you know, Iran-Contra, that whole drug-running operation out of there. Larry Nichols, you know, broke from the Clintons and tried to tell that story.
Right.
Terry Reed wrote a book on the Clinton-Bush nexus and what all of that was really all about, and it was all CIA drug-running operations under the Reagan administration. So, you know,
now remember, Goldman was doing a lot of the laundering at MENA, Arkansas, so they were deep
in it as well. Yeah, right. So, you know, we're looking, again, that, you know, that's one down in the rape of Russia scenario column. But by the same token, you can't fund a, you cannot have that kind of covert operation if people do not have discretionary income to spend on their illegal drugs. So, you know, we're back to square one. They've harvested, I think, just about every last dime that they can, and they've got to do something different. And the only way to do that is to get the regulatory boot off of people and get some discretionary income back into the middle class's hands. So
let me tell you what my big fear is here. Let's say their intention is to do a positive return on investment.
Okay.
And so they're looking to decentralize. So let's say they're looking to have venture pools for neighborhoods and neighborhoods crowdfunding and lots more decentralized small business and take the boot off small business and do all this wonderful stuff. If, however, you've got a digital system and network that is full of entrainment and mind control, and you're putting chips in everybody, then you're just talking about friendly fascism.
Right.
You know, it's all going to look lovely and maybe people feel okay economically. But frankly, I really don't, I'm not interested in being a chipped member of the middle class.
Oh, I'm not either. I'm not either. And you know, fascism is a danger in all movements like this. It's always an inherent danger of movements like this. We just, you know, the real thing here that we have to bear in mind is we just have to say no. And if there's any glimmer of a message like that in the cards, then their feet have to be held to the fire that we're just not going to do that. I don't see them attempting to do anything like that, because I think too many people are already awake and aware and alive to the dangers of that sort of thing. And it would, if they were to move too quickly on it, it would collapse the coalition that put them into office. You know, Congress would start getting so much phone calls that this would collapse, and then if that happened, the agenda is up. You know, they couldn't be trusted to do anything else. So I'm not too pessimistic on that score right off the bat. A lot's going to depend, as we've said before, on what he says during that first State of the Union address that's coming up later this month. We're gonna find out a lot about that. We're gonna find out a lot about what his intentions are with how he handles all of the executive orders that Obama has put into place. I expect he'll repeal some of them. But again, those are the things that we have to watch for.
Right. I don't know if you saw this little tidbit. He met with the head of AT&T, and they said they didn't discuss their Time Warner, their proposed Time Warner merger. But shortly thereafter, after meeting with Trump, they talked, someone mentioned, I forget if it was AT&T or Time Warner, mentioned that one thing that might make the merger go is if they spun out CNN.
Yep.
And I thought, wow, Trump really got CNN back.
Yep.
They're getting dumped out on their own financially. That's talk about payback.
Yep, exactly.
Yep. Yeah.
That was a body blow to the solar plexus. This is the other thing about what you're watching is the old ways of dealing with presidents from the media. You know, they're not dealing with a lawyer, like you say. They're dealing with a guy that knows the business world and knows how it operates.
Right.
And now he's got his hands on the levers of power, and you know that's a clear indicator that he's going to use them.
So here's let me just keep coming back to Goldman Sachs. Here's what we've got. We've got a firm which traditionally I have associated with having major responsibilities for the CIA and the intelligence community on both the hidden system of finance and on the black budget, CIA and Treasury. And what I'm watching is them aligning with a president-elect who's basically having a war with the CIA and refusing to take briefings from them because they just repeat themselves and you'd rather hear from Booz Allen.
Right.
And that's why I come back to, are we looking at a privatization of the covert side of finance, or a realignment of a privatized finance side with the military and military intelligence?
I think you're definitely looking at the latter. Again, the structure of power of the deep state behind Trump looks to me, I don't know how it looks to you, but it looks to me like what you have within the intelligence community, all the three-letter agencies, is you have agencies like ONI, DIA, National Reconnaissance Office, National Security Agency, and so on, that are aligning with Trump. And what they're doing is they're leaving the CIA out in the cold.
And let me ask you something. If you have ONI, DIA, NSA, and NRO, mm-hmm. what do you need the CIA for?
You don't. That's
what
that's
is it
my
that
point.
They do that you need?
Well, the only thing that the CIA does that you could conceivably need
is the drug dealing.
Is the drug dealing and the covert ops, precisely. But, you know, the other intelligence agencies are as capable of running covert ops as the CIA. So, in other words, it's looking to me like you're seeing a classical walling off. In other words, they're not going to get rid of the CIA. They're just going to make it irrelevant. And gradually, over time, the budget will sink. And the national security resources, financial resources, will go into those other agencies. I suspect, you know, if that reading is correct, you know, and that's a big if, let's admit it, it's a big if.
Right.
But if that reading is correct, then I suspect at some point in either his first or second administration, if he gets a second one, you're going to see a restructuring, a major restructuring of the entire intelligence structure in this country. I think that's in the cards if that reading of things is correct. The other thing that you've mentioned and that we've talked about is that the intelligence communities are only one part of this. You're watching something else happen in the Pentagon, as you've pointed out. you've got the people that are interested in actual operational productivity rather than all the fluff coming in here.
Right.
So that restructuring, I think you're going to see eventually touch the Pentagon itself. I don't think he would be picking these people that he's picking if that weren't in the cards down the line at some point. And again, the alignment of that faction with Goldman Sachs and so on, the financial aspect of things, you're dealing with people that are interested in production. They're interested in positive return on investment, be that in weapons systems for the military or what have you. So again, that's another one in that positive return on investment column.
Right. So let me put this in perspective. We had a financial coup d'etat. We pulled all the assets out of 2.0. Now
right.
2.0 is filled up with liabilities, and the question is, okay, it's time for the end game. We have to re-engineer 2.0. How's that going to happen? Who's going to do it? What's going to happen? And you have a group of people coming in saying, wait a minute, if we try and keep the unipolar goal model going with 2.0, it's too high risk, we're going to fail and get killed. So we need to reground, we need to resource back into North America, we need to rebuild. The question is, if they rebuild and rebuild the military, mm-hmm. are they then going to turn around and want to go back out to war?
That's a good question. That's certainly a possibility, because Trump has already made it clear that he wants to build up the military again. That's certainly a possibility, but geopolitically, I don't see that happening for several reasons that we've already talked about. The Japanese rapprochement with Russia, Mr. Abe is playing a very, very good diplomatic game, from what I can tell, and a very aggressive one. We haven't seen this out of a Japanese prime minister since the end of the war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not since Tojo. So.
And I should say, you know, Goldman Sachs has a very important Tokyo office.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They were always a major player. You know, Goldman, the Japanese have traditionally had big investments in Goldman Sachs' equity.
Well, the other thing there, too, is, you know, there's no doubt in my mind that Goldman Sachs played a role in that Japanese bank pledging so many billions of dollars to
I'm sure.
interest, you know, there's no
right.
doubt in my mind that they played a role
right.
in that. So the geopolitical situation, I don't think portends another return to the unipolar empire war scenario. I think what you're looking at is not only an attempt to build up North America, but to shift the attention to China. You know, we can't be the world's policeman, so we're going to put the bulk of our assets where we have been seeing significant challenges from the Chinese, Africa being one place, the Pacific certainly being another. And that's what I see in the cards in terms of the long-term military strategy that we're looking
right.
at.
Right. The pressure now will be they care more about the South China Sea and asserting hegemony in the Asia. If you lose that hegemony in Asia, you're in real serious trouble.
Very,
and Tillerson
very
made it
trouble.
Very yeah. Tillerson made it very clear that he was gonna be aggressive there. One comment I saw, I didn't hear it because I haven't listened to the entire Tillerson testimony, but one question was whether or not Tillerson was going to keep DynCorp on. DynCorp, of course, being the contractor, they've always been a lead contractor at state, but the contractor with the most allegations. They've had two lawsuits against them in the 90s, early 2000 on pedophilia and mm-hmm. sex slave trafficking. And, of course, mm-hmm. with the pedophilia allegations running around, DynCorp is a name that's bouncing around again.
All right.
But I thought it was interesting that somebody asked him about that. And what was most interesting to me about the Tillerson hearing, I don't know if you watched any of it, Rubio, Senator Rubio, made a complete fool of himself.
Well, and I'm not surprised.
It was frightening to watch that someone, a sitting senator, would be that
clueless?
Not only naive, but ridiculous.
Look,
and
I'm
if
not
you look at the fake news coverage of it, you know, they made him sound like he was being, you know, he was behaving in a senatorial manner. He demanded that Tillerson declare that Putin was a war criminal. And if you're a nominee for Secretary of State and you have not had access to the classified documentation, there's no way you can respond to that. You just can't.
No.
It's not possible. And you certainly can't do it without conferring and agreeing with the National Security Council, you know, advisor and the president.
Exactly.
You know, and for a senator to ask you to do that is just, it's kind of, you know, it's you feel like the theme song to the Howdy Doody show should start playing.
Yep,
and
exactly.
Okay, well, I think there's no doubt. Mate Yibi wrote a wonderful article about Goldman Sachs where he likened them to a vampire squid. And it's very funny, article, and well deserved. But it's true they have a tentacle in everything. And if there is one financial institution that knows where all, I mean, the one who really knew a lot of the bodies was AIG, because they were, in my opinion, running the insurance book on the black budget and hidden system of finance stuff. But
yep.
Once they got turned topsy-turvy during the bailouts, Goldman emerged as the, you know, and Lehman too. Lehman had a lot on the covert side. So you get rid of AIG and Lehman, or sort of trounce them, and that leaves Goldman as the number one sort of hidden system of finance black budget firm. So these are guys who know where all the bodies are buried. So if they're going to flip the model, you need people who mechanically know how to do it and know where all the bodies are buried. The question is, who are they working for? And that's the last thing I want to talk about. How do we keep an eye on this? How do we watch? Because I think if enough people in the media, I think Trump is sincere enough, having been through the campaign, and he's enough of a businessman to know that if you eat the pie as opposed to build a bakery, then you know, it's good for a dinner, but that's all. So there are people in the mix who understand that you want to build something enduring as opposed to just rape the place.
Right.
And so the question is, what do we as citizens and individuals need to encourage the, you know, let's build a bakery instead of just eat the pie?
Well, we have to watch carefully. The whole problem with the scenarios that we've been talking about, positive return on investment, are we going to turn the Titanic, or is this going to be another rape of Russia scenario, is if you were inclined to look just simply at his Goldman Sachs appointments, you would have to say, well, it's looking more like a rape of Russia scenario. But when you consider those appointments against the broader backdrop of his other appointments, then it's looking more like positive return on investment scenario. You also have to factor in the messages that he has been sending, you know, the carrier air conditioning thing, the Ford plant being staying in the United States rather than going overseas, which, of course, Ford came out and said, well, this has nothing to do with Donald Trump, which is, of course, nonsense. It has everything to do with with
right.
Trump. But you have to look at the messages that he's sending in that sense and the messages that he has sent prior to the election. You've pointed out yourself the Davos desperation with the move towards cashlessness, and Trump saying over and over that if you want to have secure communications, send things by courier, you know, write it out and send it by courier because no computer is safe. Well, you know, what he really has said is, you know, a cashless digital system of daily transactions is just not going to work. That's what he said, because
right.
It's not secure. So you have to look at his messages as well, as simply at his appointments. Those are the things that I would urge people to do. In other words, we can't panic too quickly. about things. The proof is in the pudding. The proof is in the actions that are taken. The other thing I think that we need to look very carefully at, as to whether or not we're dealing with a rape or positive return on investment scenario, is how do his plans translate locally and regionally, in other words, place-based.
Right.
If those plans translate to positive things happening locally, then I would say you're looking at a positive thing. You're looking at that positive return on investments, that they're serious about it. If, on the other hand, trillions of dollars are appropriated for infrastructure, and Obama did this. We have to remember that this was something that he did very quickly in his administration. But what did it translate into locally? Well, I can tell you what it translated into locally where I live. A certain section of the freeway was repaired, it was updated, made all nice and new and shiny. But most of the freeway system where I live is in tatters. The roads are bumpy, the bridges are, literally melting before your eyes. So what happened was you created a big bureaucracy, and paid more fluff. We saw the solar panel industry, got special perks and privileges under Obama and did absolutely nothing. So for me, the proof is in the pudding. Is this infrastructure project that he's been talking in glittering generalities, is this going to issue in anything actually that's going to have an effect locally? So
Right.
that's what I would urge people to do. What's going to be the consequence of this locally? And by say we have to watch, what I mean is what we have to do is hold their feet to the fire. And when they come out with all these grand plans and announcements, we have to demand that they explain, well, what is this going to do for us in Shreveport or Texarkana or whatever? What exactly are we benefiting here? I remember, as you probably remember, when Eisenhower passed the National Defense Highway Act to create the interstate system. As the interstate system was being built, you would come up to places on the interstate where you'd have to get off the old road, and there would be a big sign that would say, "Your tax dollars at work." And the sign would spell out how much money was being spent here. And I remember this very vividly. This was an actual attempt at local transparency of how much money was
Right.
being spent. And we don't see that anymore. And I think that's exactly what the federal government, in order to restore confidence and trust in what they're doing, have to do. They have to put those old signs back up. We're adding this addition to your airport. We're upgrading the radar here, and this is how much it's costing. This is how much is being financed, blah, blah, blah. Those old signs were a very, very crucial part of the success of Eisenhower's interstate system program that we've all benefited
Last
from enormously.
year, I wrote a letter to my congressman, basically saying, "Look, it won't cost you a penny. You already have the resources to do it. Just put up the place-based financial disclosure on your websites, and let's all go to work." Because one of the ways you turn a negative to a positive is you get all the intelligence in the area working to turn it positive, and may the best plan win.
And
So,
the congressman, if I remember correctly, Catherine, don't the congressmen have a certain discretionary budget for their mailers to their constituents and so on, where they could be
oh,
putting information? Yeah, they could be
sure.
doing this very easily.
Yeah.
And I get mailers from my congressman all the time, but there's no information in it.
Right. Right.
If I saw a budgetary breakdown of what they're doing here and what they're doing here and what the money's going for, I'd sit down and read the thing.
I'm having an unprecedented number of questions come in from subscribers looking for help in figuring out both local budgets as well as the underfunded pension and other liabilities in their area because it's starting to impact them personally.
Sure.
And they're starting to say, "Well, wait a minute, let me look at the money." And I'm getting all sorts of questions, how to. And right. In fact, one subscriber I offered to help them figure out the detail and to teach them how to understand the money in their place if they would write up the experience so I could publish it for all the subscribers. So hopefully that will happen. But, you know, all this money is going to start being real to everyone. And I know all the reasons why government officials don't want to make all this stuff easily accessible and public. But I don't see how we reoptimize and get things headed in a positive direction without that kind of transparency.
I don't either. So, I don't either. And it would be so easy to do.
Right.
You know, it would be just from the standpoint of good government. The federal government is held in such low esteem by people right now, and rightly so, precisely because of this lack of transparency. So again, I go back to my, you know, those old interstate signs that we saw in the 60s as they were building out the interstate system, you know, your tax dollars at work, and that specified exactly what it was going for. If you had that kind of national effort to hold themselves accountable, they would restore trust, and in the restoration of trust, they would restore confidence. And that's an essential part of a functioning economy.
Okay, so if you're Goldman Sachs, the way you made money was by that system being secret. You centralize and use fraud to rig trillions of dollars to be able to go global or go down the hidden system of finance and black budget, wherever. $50 trillion missing in a financial coup, all made possible by secrecy, privilege, and centralization.
Right.
So how is it a company and a culture that succeeded wildly from this process of centralization, secrecy, and privilege would agree to take it in the opposite direction?
Because they have to. I personally think, again, going back to everything that we've said, because they have to. You can't have a functioning economy that is based on parasitism. And parasitism only survives in that kind of secretive context, because of the fact of the matter is, you know, you can build out all the infrastructure you want to, but if you don't have people that can afford a car to drive down the interstate or buy a train ticket or a plane ticket to fly into these new airports, what good is it going to do you? So you've got to restore the discretionary income of the middle class. You've got to raise up the lower classes and give them a stake. You know, we've talked several times about the racism and bigotry that has been shown to the black populations in the urban centers. And to create that kind of trust, you're going to have to not only show them where the money is going in terms of the actual numbers on the ledger, you're going to have to show them that you're actually building something with it. They can't, in other words, Goldman Sachs may be inclined by all of their lights and corporate history to continue the secrecy thing, but the fact of the matter is the secrecy thing has run its course. It's part of that debt finance model that's run its course, and they can't do that anymore. They've got to produce their way out of it.
Well, here's one place. There are two places where the rubber's going to meet the road. One is Ben Carson's going to be over at HUD.
Yep, that's
it. And you're making a fortune on bringing drugs into that neighborhood and engaging in financial fraud, mortgage fraud in those neighborhoods. How are you going to end that game? Are you going to end that game? You know, because then you're talking, that's where the rubber's going to meet the road over at HUD.
That is where the rubber meets the road. And you know, again, this goes back to the scenario that it looks to me, and again, you know, this is another big whopping speculation if here, but it's at least looking to me like they are walling off the CIA. And, of course, the CIA has been most of that covert drug trading activity.
Right.
So, in walling off the CIA, they're creating the climate to do what you're suggesting and going into those neighborhoods and lifting those people up a bit. So this is all a comprehensive thing. And you know, if we're correct, then this has been carefully planned and plotted for some time.
So So here's the other place where it breaks down. You've got a whole group of people who are over 65. You know, some will keep working for some period of time. So let's say, you know, over 70, and they're an expense. They're no longer, they're not going to help you build the muscle. But the reality is, you know, they're the grandparents or the relatives of somebody who is going to help you build the muscle. So it's hard to separate them out.
Right. And, yeah, I agree. By restoring the local place-based financing and restoring the transparency of it, you're going to create enough of a climate where this is no longer a drag on the system. So, you know, again, it looks to me like they've got to do these things. It's not a matter of whether they want to do these things. It's really a matter of they have to do these things. So, you know, for me, let me turn the roles around a bit here. I've been telling people, Catherine, for a few weeks that, you know, I'm cautiously optimistic about what I'm seeing, and I'm more on the caution side than the optimism side. So I tell people I'm about 60% cautious about what we're seeing and 40% optimistic. So if you were to break it down in terms of those kinds of numbers, are you more cautious or are you more optimistic?
You know, right now I would say 50-50.
Yeah.
I think there's something going on here spiritually and energetically.
Yes, I do too.
That is, you know, I think part of what's happening is the field. So I think you have 325 million Americans. And one of the things I've discovered, whether doing competitive process on financial assets or just dealing with media of different kinds, anything involving big fields in America, the American people are, when you get them all together and you get them thinking and talking about the big issues, they're unbelievably smart. You know, we can be so stupid in the short run, or so stupid about something important, but when in situations like this, they really do understand, you know, that you have to grow the goose that lays the golden eggs. You can't just slaughter it and eat it for dinner. And they're surprisingly long-term in their thinking, but they're also deeply pro-human. And I think they understand that there's been something going on which is deeply anti-human, and I think they're deeply offended by it. And so I think there's something going on in the field which is extremely positive.
Yeah, and that transcends all of these nuts, bolts, and details, yeah. Yeah,
right.
I would agree.
And I think Trump, when he got out on the campaign trail, he's a ferociously competitive guy, and he got out on the campaign trail and spent months and months and months, and he got deeply vested in the notion that he could make, you know, he could preserve and grow the goose.
Mm-hmm.
So I think his ego is very deeply entwined with the idea that he can make America great again.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I think there's a whole world of people behind him who want to see America in a position to go back out to war and win.
Yeah, I do too.
And, mm-hmm. Right. And so they're looking to rebuild the military machine. And the reality is, if you look at the waste in the national security infrastructure in this country, it's just unbelievable.
It's enormous. It's obscene.
Right. It's obscene. It's obscene. That's the perfect word. It's obscene. Now, I also think there's something else at play here, and the person who really brought it to the fore was Putin when he said, I guess it was at the UN, and you and I were talking about this earlier, when he said, "Do you realize what you've done?"
Right.
I think it's just beginning to dawn on America how frightening what we've done over the last 20 years was, and
right.
You know, and Sir James Goldsmith warned us how frightening what we were planning on doing was. And, you know, I think the backlash is really here, and it's putting us in enormous, as a country, in enormous danger.
Yes, I do
so,
too.
Right. So I agree with you. They have to do something. and it would be stupid to just do a raid because where do you go? They don't have more set up yet.
Yep, they don't. So, you know, bottom line is if we combine our numbers, we're looking at a 55 on the caution side and a 45 on the optimism side. Yeah, that's kind of the way I think too. There is something about what we've seen happening in the country that transcends all of this nuts and bolts stuff. It's in the field, and we're seeing the same thing happening in Europe. So this is not just an America only phenomenon. We're seeing it. We're seeing it in France and Italy, Germany, the Netherlands. It's interesting. I watched Marine Le Pen last night on YouTube, and she was saying many of the same things that we're saying. And you know, it's in other words, it's a message that's not necessarily confined to Trump or his supporters. It's something that appears to be happening all over the world, including inside of Russia. So it's going to be an interesting 4 years, needless to say.
So here's, I think, the question. The question is, can Goldman Sachs serve the humanists well for a profit?
Oh, I think so. I think they could. I think any big investment bank could, if they put their talent and analytical skills to figuring out how to go about doing it. The thing here that's interesting to me, Catherine, is that it does look increasingly to me like they have been thinking along these lines for quite a while. In other words, I don't think what you're seeing now with Trump is simply accidental. It's come out recently that, you know, this was something that they've been thinking about for a while and that they first approached him about running back in 2008. I've heard stories to that effect. So in other words, it's looking to me like they've had this big master plan going in their heads for a while, because I'm not looking at what he's been doing is just shooting from the hip or accidental. These are very, very, very carefully thought out appointments and messages, the timing that he has exhibited during the campaign for some of his more quote-unquote outlandish statements. Those didn't strike me, and they still, and I fully grant everyone that's listening, I fully grant that you know, I'm odd man out here. Most people view his comments as just being, well, that's just Donald Trump, you know, the narcissist. I'm thinking that he dropped those comments at different points during the campaign very carefully and deliberately at carefully timed moments. They were not just shooting from the hip and Trump being Trump. So it's looking to me like we're looking at something very deliberate. But over and above that, like you say, I think there's something in the field. I think there's a spiritual, cultural aspect to this that no one could have planned. That there's other factors and forces in play here that I think are changing things around. Time will tell, you know. And in the meantime, we just have to keep holding their feet to the fire.
Right. There's one other thing I wanted to bring up. I got an email. I think I told you about this earlier. I got an email from someone who said to me, are you ready for the kleptocracy?
Yeah.
And, you know, referring to this new crew coming in. And I wrote back and I said, there's $50 trillion that's gone missing since 1995. What do you mean coming?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think the power of what can happen is if you have 3,100 counties take responsibility, you know, to move on down the road. And I think one of the things that helps us see that clearly is, you know, it always helps to know what your history is and where you've come from. But we've gone through a kleptocracy, the likes of which the Western civilization has never known. And Obama contributed to it more than, I mean, he's the one that made it all possible. He consolidated the financial coup d'etat, and our Just a Taste that we just put up this tonight is about that. It's from you and I discussing it in the annual wrap-up. So I think the biggest obstacle is not Goldman Sachs. I think the biggest obstacle is the refusal of the American people to push the red button and take responsibility for how we got here and where we have to go.
Yep.
So if you think, you know, I worked at Goldman Sachs, and if you think they're pigs, boy, you should meet some of my neighbors. Well, the debasement, you know, the debasement of the culture is across the board.
Yes, it is.
And we're going to have to turn it around one person and one family and one county at a time.
Here.
Yeah.
I've been saying that for years, you know, telling my website members that we as individuals are now responsible for maintaining and handing down to our progeny the traditions and institutions of Western civilization. And that means we have to know what those traditions are in their high form, in their high expression, not in the modern debased barbaric form that they have become. We're now all responsible for it. And
maybe we should suggest to Trump that he ought to play some Bach at the inauguration ceremony.
Well, I don't know what he listens to, but it can't hurt. You know? It certainly can't hurt.
Well, anyway, so Goldman Sachs' stock is flying, and I will say this, Joseph, the capital gains opportunity, if you re-engineered bottom-up in the United States, is quite extraordinary.
Oh,
and it's clear to me from what Goldman's up to and Warren Buffett's up to, they're all sort of licking their chops. So, you know, it's there to be done, and we can, you know, we can do the end game on Global 2.0 in a way that could work. It's not going to be easy, but I think it's going to take all of us, I think it's going to take all of us, and it'll be very interesting. I think you're right. We need to hold their feet to the fire, and it's funny because I just had another person lobby me for going into the work in the administration, and I just wanted to reach the screen and punch them because I thought, you know, how many people are there in the independent media who know enough about Wall Street and Washington to hold these folks' feet to the fire? Why would you want to lose them?
Right, exactly. Here.
Okay, well, let's make their life difficult, shall we?
Let's do that. Here.
Okay, before we close, anything else on Goldman Sachs?
Nope, that's it.
There was, during the when so many Goldman people were coming in under Obama, there was a great quote from an Indonesian cab driver who said, "Why is Goldman Sachs running your country?" And I would say it's because they know where all the bodies are buried. That's why. But the way I would close out is I'd say I do think we're looking at a streamlining of the covert side of the financial house.
Yeah, and, it needs to be done. It's long
overdue. It needs to be done, but it's a major power shift. And
yep.
So I don't think the fireworks are anywhere near from over. But
oh, no, I don't either. No way.
Yeah.
No way. That when I say I'm cautiously optimistic, 60-40, 60 caution, 40 optimistic, most of that caution is based on how bumpy it's probably going to get and the degree of nasty fighting that we're going to see.
Right. It's a lot of nasty fighting because you have a lot of scorpion nests in this thing. You have people who, you know, I said this in Money and Markets earlier this week, but you see on Trump's face, you know, the beauty of New York, if you're a real estate developer or you're at Goldman Sachs, is there's a limit to how much you'll fight because fighting doesn't make money. I mean, it can make money sometimes, but the guy you're fighting with today is the guy you'll be in a syndicate with tomorrow, and life is long. Everybody's trying to make money, and so the fights get bad and they get ugly and people can be mean, but it always comes back around to the fact that you have to add value in the marketplace or else nobody makes any money.
Right.
So you can't just make money by stealing other people's pies. You have to bake pies. So
yep.
What Trump is now running into is people who are not subject to that ethic. You know, they believe in just always throwing up toll booths and fighting. They're scorpions. And they don't feel any compunction to make the system work or go. Just print more money. That'll solve the problem, right?
Yep.
And that's the hardest thing to get rid of if you get rid of the debt growth model is the people who have no culture or character associated with sustainable economics.
Yeah, that is part of the ideological conflict that I think that we've seen in this last election, and we're seeing it reproducing itself in Europe. We saw it with the Brexit. It's two different cultures. It's the central bank welfare warfare model on the one hand with the privileged snowflakes, and on the other, it's the people paying the taxes to give the privileged snowflakes their privileges. So, you know, it's the pie eaters and the pie bakers, folks.
Right. Okay, Joseph, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us on the Solari Report.
All right, Catherine. Thanks for having me back on.
Bye.
Bye-bye.